Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And on this episode, we're going to be diving into some gender discrimination.
And I feel like if we're going to have a conversation about the pink tax, which we are, with Danielle Paquette from Wonk Blog, who is awesome, I also sort of feel like I need to vent for a second.
Go for it.
So this has happened to me like three times now, but I this is the first time I'm mentioning it on the show because it's the first time we've talked about the pink tax. And Tracy, has this ever happened to you? I've gone on dates, not great dates, actually pretty terrible
yes, that
dates.
That has happened to me.
Oh, that's happened to you. Yeah. Okay, well, so terrible dates that weren't just terrible, but at the end when I am trying to split the check with the guy, he's like, oh, no, I'm going to pay. And doesn't just stop there, but actually gives me a whole speech about how women cost more, our lives cost more. And I say, do you mean like the gender pay gap? How
right.
I get paid less? And oh, no. He's talking about how our upkeep costs more.
Maybe when my dates look at me, they realize I don't invest in my upkeep all that long, because that's never happened to me.
And so I think the reason I feel the need to vent about this, right, is that there's some truth to that, right? And that's part of what we're going to talk about with Danielle Paquette and other folks in this episode, is that there is a so-called pink tax, right? That actually some of the same products, the men's and women's versions, cost different, even though they're the same darn thing.
Right.
And the woman's version will end up costing more, perhaps because companies think women will pay more for things. But I guess the reason this pisses me off so much is because there's some truth to it and they're kind of right.
Well, but I appreciate you throwing him a bone. I think that though he's not realizing that it's the same things that you guys do. You have the same upkeep that will cost more. So we also don't need a male savior. What we need is consumer protection.
But that's exactly why I feel the need to vent
yes.
about this. Right? What we need is better policies,
exactly.
Not for all of the men out there to take us out and pay for us.
Right.
That's not the solution.
Exactly.
It's. I'm done with the patronizing dates.
Absolutely.
Right? So there, I'll get off my overpriced soapbox that costs more for women than it does for men.
But luckily, we'll just dive into those issues a bit more and talk about some of the solutions to that, which again is not men buying us cheap wine.
To be clear, men listeners, we hope that you have heard us.
And we're also going to be talking about North Carolina and their efforts to roll back rights for LGBT individuals, but also broader across the board, and how scary that development is. So stay tuned.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross.
We are extremely pleased to have with us Danielle Paquette. She is a reporter for the Washington Post Wonk blog. She covers business and policy. And you, our listeners might often hear about the gender wage gap. They might even be familiar with the fact that women are disproportionately likely to work in low wage and minimum wage jobs, but perhaps less well known, and something that you, Danielle, have written a great deal about, is that there are also hidden price disparities. It actually costs more to be a woman. Tell us a little bit about what you found in looking into this.
Sure. Well, the people who are upset over this are aware that women, on average, make 79 cents for every dollar paid to men. Some people say that has to do with choice. Others say discrimination plays a large role. Last year, at the very end of the year, I wrote a story about new research from New York. And researchers in the city just looked at hundreds and hundreds of products and found, on average, that items marketed at girls and women cost 11% more than items marketed to boys and men.
Give us an example. Like, what kinds of items are marketed to women versus men?
So the most ridiculous example I found was on the Target website. There was a scooter This red scooter cost something like $29.99, but the exact scooter when it was pink cost $49.99. So why was there a $20 difference?
Literally the same scooter.
Yes.
The only difference is the color.
Same weight, same everything. I reached out to Target. I wondered why. And the company told me, well, you know, it's complicated when you're setting prices. A lot of it has to do with what the manufacturer says. But, you know, that wasn't an anomaly.
And in your piece, you talk about how some people believe that maybe this has to do with the fact that, you know, when it comes to products like shampoos or razors or these other items that both men and women use frequently, that women might be willing to spend more on a better branded shampoo. What do you think is actually the case? What's going on here?
So that might be part of it. You know, basic economics would suggest that if the consumer is willing to spend this, then the companies will keep those prices higher. I talked to one economist at Yale who had this theory that men's products, whether it be shampoo, conditioner, what have you, are considered normal, average. But women's might be priced special or specialty. And so there's this premium on those products, even if the ingredients are identical and maybe the only difference is the color or a hint of sparkle.
So women are some, a special class. The men are the normal people. And then all of us in this room, we need extra care, even if it's the exact same product.
But that was one of the questions I had, though, right? Was like, I don't know, you go to CVS and you're going to go buy a pack of razors or something, right? And you see the women-y razors that have all
women. I assume that means pink or purple, women-y.
Well, no, it's not just the colors, right? They have like the moisturizing blades,
right.
And like maybe they have more blades and they have like extra things on them. And oh, look, when you touch the button, something comes out of it and it's like extra shaving cream. Like, I'm being serious.
Right,
it's like,
right.
These are, I probably spent 20 minutes in the freaking aisle at CVS like 2 weeks ago because I hadn't bought razors in a while and like something happened and now they have all these
Rebecca features,
right? But anyway, I'm like an old person like hiding in a 31-year-old's mouth, right? I'm like, there's newfangled razors. My point being, like, part of what I wondered when I was reading your work on this was like, is it that the women's versions are just fancy schmancier, or is it actually that even when they're the same, they still cost more?
So Schick, that brand, they had identical razor cartridges. One, the packaging was purple, the other was blue or silver or something. And when you look at them closely, again, they appeared to be the same thing. So you start to wonder what's going on here. I reached out to those razor companies and, they told me the text. They responded with the text that's on the marketing website. You know, women, their hands are different. You know, the razor fits differently. I'm paraphrasing, of course.
Wait, seriously.
You can find it on the website.
This was like the pen. This is like the pen scan.
Right. Those.
Right?
The pens for ladies.
The pens for ladies that were like special and different because we're special and different.
Right.
And I'm sure, anyone in here might shave their legs. Have you ever used a men's razor? I have. It's not, my hand doesn't just freeze up when I use it.
And, when Rebecca opened with, citing the wage gap, citing the fact that women are disproportionately in minimum wage jobs. So obviously the fact that women earn less, and then when they're going into shops, they're presented with higher prices without maybe even realizing it because they're drawn to what's marketed to them. This, presents problems. What, through your, analysis of the report, how does this impact low-income consumers?
Well, people call this the pink tax, and I would imagine it just means people are spending more money when they don't necessarily need to.
And by people, you mean women.
Women, right. Women are people. We're half the population. We're not a specialty group. It is strange. The people in New York who studied all of these items and compared them, they just tried to raise awareness. Hey, be very aware when you're shopping. It doesn't appear that anytime soon companies will change their pricing here due to social outrage. So what you can do is vote with your dollar and just, maybe buy your daughter the red scooter instead of the pink scooter.
But if I understand correctly, though, Target, after your piece ran and the reports were out, they did adjust the price on some items, right? So there is a factor of raising awareness in these that can lower the price, that it shows that it's not inherently necessary to have these prices be so different.
Sure, sure thing. Target only did that after they were called out in this report. You know, as a journalist, you have a platform, but your average low-income female shopper does not have that platform. Of course, we've seen people on Twitter spark all kinds of amazing social movements. So definitely, yes, speak out, you know? But really, I haven't seen the prices change very much with razors, though, for example. So it's really just a case-by-case kind of thing.
But it's not just products you found, right? I mean, maybe you can buy the red scooter instead of the pink scooter. And to some extent, you know, shopping against type, right, might advantage women, or at least not disadvantage women. But you also found, and this report finds, that it's also services, right? The one that kind of shocked me a little bit was dry cleaning, maybe because I don't actually dry clean anything ever, but also like health insurance, and there's all sorts of stuff where you don't have a choice. You can't shop differently. You are going to be discriminated against. Talk a little bit about this difference in services too.
Sure. So lawmakers in certain parts of the country have actually started addressing this. I know that in one county in Florida, I believe it's Miami-Dade, they actually said, hey, it's illegal to price women differently for getting a shirt dry cleaned than men. California has something similar. New York City has something similar. But the vast area of the country, if you're a woman and you go in to get a haircut, or if you go in to get a shirt that your husband could wear dry cleaned, it's very likely that you might encounter higher prices.
And so I think there's a kind of a widespread myth with the dry cleaning example that, well, oh, you know, women's clothes might be more delicate or require more care because, you know, we like our frilly, silky things. But these are price variations on the same sorts of materials and the same sorts of tailoring. So it really is a gender-based thing and not necessarily about the care required for the product or, you know, whatever the other service might be.
Sure. In my research, I read that certain hairdressers, when you're trimming a woman's hair, it might take 15 minutes. It'll also take 15 minutes to give the guy a buzz cut. So there are certain situations where it really isn't that more labor-intensive. The dry cleaners in the Miami area, I read, also are kind of responding to these laws by saying, okay, instead of men's and women's shirt, we'll say this much for a ruffled shirt, or this much for a silk shirt, or this much for a cotton shirt. So it doesn't matter your gender, you pay a flat price.
So basically, if you're a dude, you're fine, unless you're Jerry Seinfeld.
I was about to say.
Were you really going to bring up the puffy shirt episode?
I really was.
The mind meld is complete.
I've never felt closer to you, Rebecca.
And we should just say we're all wearing really roughly puffy shirts right now in solidarity.
Very beautiful shirts.
And another issue that's gotten, I think, a lot more attention in the past few weeks is related to a specific product related to tampons. Mm. So last week in Chicago, the city council voted to classify pads and tampons as medical necessities, not luxury items. New York State.
We should pause there just for like to let people take
right.
that in. Right. The fact that tampons and women's hygiene products, right, have for a long time actually been classified as luxury items,
right,
and thus subject to sales tax in most cities, right? Not condoms.
Right.
Those are medical necessities.
Right.
Those aren't subject to tax, but tampons and pads.
Right, right, exactly. And the New York State Assembly passed similar legislation. So can you unpack a little bit about, you know, what Rebecca started describing, mm-hmm, is, you know, what's really at play with this quote-unquote tampon tax?
So President Obama actually addressed this in January. He was asked that exact question, and he said, wow, I have no idea. Maybe the men made those laws, or maybe the men set those taxes. Who's to say? I don't think there were a bunch of dudes setting out to discriminate against women, but what has
happened? Because that's never happened before.
What has happened is, in 40 states, tampons are not labeled under tax codes as necessities. Well, now we have women saying, actually, the only other alternative would to be bleeding everywhere. If we don't have pads, if we don't have sanitary liners, if we don't have tampons, what are we doing? Are we improvising with toilet paper?
We're going to go back to the red tent, right?
Yeah.
Which
right.
we all had to read in high school, right?
where
like women all have to go sit in a big tent on like a bale of hay for a week and
yep.
like chill. Like
it,
that's the alternative, folks.
Yeah. So there's just really, you know, objectively, you can't not have menstrual products when you're on your period. And that is the argument of this movement.
And so there have been, I guess, some pushback to the idea that this tampon tax is something that we really need to tackle, because it comes out to be a relatively tiny tax on each, you know, box of tampons or package of pads. So over the course of a year, it could be around $8 or so that in taxes that people are covering this. Why is this something that's important? And I know that Rebecca has had personal experience with dealing with low-income people on this issue, but so I'd be interested in hearing from both of you about, you know, how you would push back from people saying that this isn't a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, what I hear is that it on principle, it can be unfair because there's no critically equivalent product for men. You know, men aren't taxed for something that they absolutely need that women don't use. So women are absorbing that economic blow. They're shouldering that extra cost. And like we discussed earlier, they already, on average, make less money, work in lower paying jobs. So the argument there is it's just not fair. This is necessary to be healthy. And also, when you look at homeless shelters, they're often, they don't have tampons or pads. And when you're homeless or you don't have much money, maybe you're selling your food stamps for sanitary items. I mean, a few dollars can make all the difference.
So it's a trade-off between necessities, really.
Sure.
And it isn't just about the tax. I mean, that's the other thing, right? There's a broader conversation that's happening right now. The hashtag free the tampons has become quite popular. I don't know that I would go so far as to say that it's trending. Maybe we'll make it trend with this episode. But it's also the cost of the items, right? So Tracy's referencing my days as a legal aid lawyer. I had clients who actually couldn't afford, either for them or for their daughters, tampons, pads, et cetera. It doesn't sound like it's a huge expense if you're, you know, doing just fine income-wise, but when your food stamps don't cover it, when you're running out of food by the third week or fourth week of the month, you know, $80, $100 a year in sanitary products, that's something you don't have money for, particularly if you're also raising kids and it's diapers. There's all this stuff. The costs really mount. And so $8 in taxes might not sound like a ton to you or to me, but when you add it on top of regressive state and local taxes, in particular sales taxes, that by and large hit low-income people the hardest, right? Any places that we can be finding ways to alleviate those tax burdens so that we have a more progressive tax system makes a lot of sense to do. So it isn't just a women's issue. It's an issue of you know, tax fairness.
Absolutely. I think that you really both highlighted that it's not even just about this one issue. It's about the compounding costs that low-income people, working women, face in society. So it's not even just the tampon tax. It's everything that is across the board, making it harder for women to get the necessities they need and their families need. One last thing that I'd be interested in hearing, you wrote about young girls in high school and how this impacts them. Can you touch on that dynamic a bit?
So you hear from guidance counselors and teachers who say that girls, they cut class or they'll go home, they'll be caught with an unexpected period. I mean, we've all been there. Who hasn't had to deal with that?
Men. No. Never mind.
Tracy hits the nail on the head. But some really compelling evidence just came out of a Queens high school in New York City. They've just launched a program to put free tampons and pads in every high school bathroom. But in Queens, where that started, I believe, last September, they saw attendance rates among the girls go up. And that is just, that can be really telling, right? Especially if it's already hard enough to get to school if you're low income, and then you face an unexpected period, which is not only uncomfortable, it can be humiliating.
So. Particularly for younger girls who are still getting used to it. Well, we'll dig more into the tampon tax and free the tampons in our next segment. But Danielle Paquette of WonkBlog, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me in studio is my colleague and friend, Kate Bond. She is an economist here at the Center for American Progress. She's also the editor of LadyEconomist.com. Kate, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks, Rebecca.
And I've brought you in because we spoke a little bit at the top of the episode, kind of broadly about the pink tax, but we started to get into the hashtag free the tampons movement, which is starting to grow in states and cities across the country. But we really wanted to dig in a little bit more on that specific issue because, I mean, I'll show my cards. It's one of my sort of pet issues going back to my days in legal aid when a lot of my clients didn't have access to sanitary products because they couldn't afford them. But it's starting to get attention as states and cities and policymakers in those places are paying attention to this and saying, what can we do? So bring us up to speed. What's the latest on the Free the Tampons movement?
Yeah, well, it's really exciting because people are talking about periods, which I feel like people haven't done before in a sort of public policy context. And so people are talking about the fact that, like, women or sort of biologically female people have specific needs that need to be sort of addressed in policy, that we can't be ignored in policy because it's a sort of a everyday part of our lives. So the tampon tax, what's neat about it is, in some sense, it is pretty small. The amount of money women are actually paying a year in tax on tampons is pretty nominal, but it's just drawing attention to the fact that women have specific needs that need to be supported through public policy and specifically cannot be penalized through poorly designed public policy that does things like makes it impossible for women to get tampons with their Medicaid or with their food stamps and charging tax on them, something that they have to use as a medical necessity.
And you hit on something that has gotten a little bit of attention in some of the media covering the Free the Tampons movement, which might not be readily apparent to folks who have not turned to public assistance and not been in that situation, which is that in-kind benefits like food stamps, like Medicaid, don't cover feminine hygiene products. The fact that they don't cover diapers has actually gotten a good amount of attention and that's kind of a gap in the safety net. But you're pointing out that feminine hygiene products, that's another gap in our safety net, but more broadly in public policy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about some of what policymakers in cities like New York, Chicago, have started to do to try to address the tampon tax and go farther than that as well.
Yeah, so there's definitely been movement to just simply eliminate the tampon tax, and it's a pretty simple thing to do. It's a pretty easy thing to do. There's been some great progress on that because I think it's something that you can do very quickly to draw attention to it. The next step is there's sort of the hashtag free the tampon, providing free tampons to women in either public spaces, schools, having better access to tampons sort of in prison systems, things like that, that just making it completely free, the same way you think you walk into like a public restroom and there's going to be free toilet paper. It's the same sort of necessity that you need as a tampon. And so more effort to realize that this is just a really basic thing that women need to be using. And so that is another thing, both eliminating the tax and also providing it free more often.
And there's been some sort of nascent discussion of changing safety net policy so that programs like food stamps or Medicaid could actually cover these kinds of products.
Yeah. So this is one thing that was in an article on Slate where they brought up the fact that the tampon tax will be mostly – eliminating the tampon tax will be mostly symbolic because it is very little – it's not a lot of money, but it paves the way to recognize that this is a medical necessity for women. And so when we recognize that it's a medical necessity is when we can start to think about ways to make it publicly provided for women who need that.
So I'm glad you brought up the Slate article by Christina Cotterucci because it points out not just what's happening in the United States, and you mentioned several of those kinds of policy levers that policymakers are pulling, but it also actually walks through how the movement to abolish the tampon tax is a global movement. I love the visual here, right? She writes, as I write these words, Prime Minister David Cameron is lobbying against the tampon tax at the EU summit in Brussels, right? Like, just, yeah. I love that, right?
Yeah. It's pretty amazing, actually. This is something that's sort of like beyond just the tampon tax, but in general, like women's biological functions and how it affects how they engage with the whole world and the whole global economy. So there is, you know, information on young girls in Africa missing school when they're getting their periods. Or there's, you know, evidence that in India, where there's not a lot of sort of latrine access, women have a really hard time sort of working in farm fields if they're in a rural area where they're working in agriculture because they can't get access to a toilet, and it means something different for women than men. So giving women sort of better access to these sort of basic, really basic things that are part of their biology helps them engage in the economy more. So that, I think, is sort of globally really fascinating, that the way women's bodies have been shamed for so long is being reclaimed, and women aren't being ashamed of their natural biological functions, and that allows them to go to school, work, do lots of different things that gives them much more empowerment if we sort of aren't ashamed of women's biology.
And maybe putting a pretty stark visual to the reclamation of something that used to be the subject of shame, British women who have been seeking to abolish the tampon tax in the UK have actually been in protest bleeding through white pants on purpose, trying to make a point and show people this is what happens if we don't have these products that we need.
This is amazing. My best friend in childhood, she was an early pioneer of wearing your white pants and middle school in protest to this happening to women. So that exact same thing happened to her, but without the political statement. Wow. So it's kind of amazing that women are doing it now proudly, that it's not embarrassing. It's not the nightmare that you go through in middle school the first time you get your period unexpectedly.
Her day has come to return to that moment and to own it and to do it on purpose.
Exactly.
I actually have memories of I had a school uniform right when I was in middle school and high school, and we had these. This is actually why I don't even own an iron as an adult, because I'm like rebelling against the fact that I had to wake up and iron these damn plaid skirts every day that just looked terrible. But I have all these memories of, you know, we were 12, we were 13-year-old girls, and we were petrified that, you know, the time of the month was going to come because it was going to show through the skirt, right?
Yeah.
It's just, I sympathize. In the last couple of minutes that we have, I wanted to bring up something that you actually said to me right before we started taping, which was whether or not such thing as a gender-neutral policy can really exist. I mean, talk a little bit about what you mean by that.
Yeah, so it's my attitude that there is no such thing as gender-neutral policy. And when we talk about gender-neutral policy, so we develop policies where we tax what we consider necessities and not necessities. Certain things are you can get with public benefits or you can't, and you're trying to do it in a gender-neutral way because you sort of theoretically would think you don't want to be doing policy that's directed towards one gender or another. That seems discriminatory. But what happens when you do that is you actually, because it's men making the policy by and large, they're ignoring women's experiences, and it becomes, in effect, sort of a male-biased policy because it's ignoring the realities of women's lives. And it's not something that's sort of, you know, mean-spirited on the part of males who make policy, but it's just what ends up happening, that they can just ignore women's experiences because it's not the first thing that comes to their mind. They don't know what it's like to be a woman. And so the idea that we're having gender-neutral policy, I think, is just like a complete falsehood and ends up becoming male-biased policy.
So is it fair to compare it to the illusory concept of a race-neutral policy?
Exactly, yeah.
So I find that to be a really interesting kind of spin on this set of issues.
So yeah, so even like with tax systems, this is like a fascinating thing, the idea that taxes somehow are gender-neutral when there is really common structures in the economy that change how you interact with the economy by race or gender. That we need to consider those things when we implement taxes or budgets or anything, because it's going to affect people differently based on those identities and those power relations that we have in society.
It brings to mind a piece I was reading in The Economist earlier this week, which I am sure you saw because it was like screaming out to be, you know, tweeted and retweeted by the likes of you. But the gist of it was that that economics that doesn't contemplate a feminist lens is missing, you know, a crucial part of the picture. And it actually makes the case for what you do, which is often called feminist economics.
Yeah, yeah. It was really exciting that The Economist sort of brought up this field that's been around since the 1980s, I would say. But The Economist acknowledging it today is still huge. There's the International Association for Feminist Economics, which I'm an active member of, does a lot of great work around this, of sort of acknowledging that you need to look at gender in order to understand the whole picture. You can't ignore it. It's such a fundamental relationship in society. It informs how we all live our lives. To ignore that this really fundamental relationship that takes place both sort of within your home to how you interact in the economy, what kind of jobs you go into, what kind of discrimination you might face. It's so fundamental to every aspect of our lives that to ignore it in economic theory and economic policy is such an oversight and again, sort of results in having sort of male biases in those fields.
And that piece argues, and I don't know if this is controversial in your field, so I'm curious mm-hmm. to hear you speak about this, for feminist economics to be an explicit sort of not standalone, but component of the field,
yeah.
rather than trying to push all of economics to apply a feminist lens. Am I reading that right, or is there a case to be made for feminist economics as such to exist on its own?
I think there's a case to be made for on its own in the way that it draws attention to those issues. I think it would sort of lose that attention on sort of truly feminist thinking and a feminist focus if we tried to sort of like incorporate it mildly through everything. The same way there's like certain fields of economics, like labor economics, focuses on the labor market. That doesn't mean that it doesn't affect other parts of economic theory, but we have a specific field to look at this one specific function in the economy, or macroeconomics or any other sort of field. It's just a specific function in it.
So we need feminist economics until we free the tampons.
Yeah, exactly.
My guest yeah. is Kate Bond. She's an economist at the Center for American Progress, and she is also the editor of LadyEconomist.com. Kate, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Tracy Ross, and I'm joined in studio by my very good friend and colleague, Sarah McBride, who is the Campaigns and Communications Manager here at the Center for American Progress for the LGBT team. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we wanted to have you on because there were some big developments this week with regard to LGBT anti-discrimination and efforts to stop that. We know that the governor of North Carolina signed a legislation that's going to be rolling back some gains. So I wanted you to help us understand what's going on and how this all started. I understand that Charlotte was actually making some strides in LGBT anti-discrimination. Can you talk us through that?
Sure. A few weeks ago, the Charlotte City Council passed a comprehensive non-discrimination ordinance, which added LGBT residents of their city to their pre-existing non-discrimination laws based on race, religion, sex, national origin. And in response, the state legislature of North Carolina and the governor of North Carolina decided that they would call a special session in order to override the city's non-discrimination ordinance. They met on Wednesday of this week and passed overwhelmingly in a single day a bill that really is probably the most anti-LGBT bill that we've ever seen in this country. It's a bill that not only overrides the Charlotte non-discrimination ordinance, it also prevents any city from in North Carolina from passing non-discrimination protections for people of any kind of background. And it specifically forbids transgender people from using restrooms in accordance with their gender identity in places like public schools. And so It's a really stark reminder that despite how much progress we've made over the last several years on LGBT rights, that the reality is most LGBT people still live in places that lack explicit protections from non-discrimination or from discrimination, and that many of them live in states that are not just failing to move the ball forward, but are actively discriminating and actively harming their LGBT residents.
And so with regard to what was specifically passed in Charlotte itself, as you mentioned, it was a wide sweeping bill, so giving protections to many groups. What was the justification in the state legislature for responding to such a wide sweeping bill and to roll back discrimination against so many groups? Because I guess what's surprising to me is that while North Carolina has so far to go with regard to LGBT rights, there are other groups where it seemed to be a much more widely accepted that we shouldn't discriminate based off of race. And so there's some greater gains in other civil rights battles. So why did they go to such far-reaching legislation?
Well, when the ordinance was initially introduced in the Charlotte City Council, the City Council failed to pass it last year. There was an interceding election where the voters of Charlotte put in place a majority on council in favor of equality. The legislation was passed, and in opposition to the ordinance in Charlotte, people trotted out an argument that we've been hearing in states across the country, and it's an argument based in fear and scare tactics. The argument goes that in ensuring that transgender people can utilize restrooms in accordance with their gender identity, that that individuals will utilize those protections to infiltrate women's restrooms to commit illegal and criminal acts like voyeurism, sexual assault, and everything in between. And it's been a tactic that anti-equality forces have used. We just saw it in South Dakota. We saw it in Tennessee. They're using it across the country. And the reality is we know that when these bills are passed, when these ordinances are passed, we've seen it in 200 cities, 18 states across the country, that there's no increase in public safety incidences due to gender identity protections. But because of that argument, the state legislature and the governor decided to amplify it on the state level, to use it for their own political gain, to try to lead the state in a way that not only rescinds these protections, but frankly, this isn't just going to the status quo. For trans people who were already using bathrooms in accordance with their gender identity, a lot of them can no longer do that. And this is really it's been done for political gain, and they are whipping up fear and hate in a way that's very dangerous and is going to have incredibly negative consequences for transgender people.
And as you said, they're using this fear to advance a broader agenda. I understand that this is going to have serious implications when it comes to the workforce and access to jobs. Can you explain that a bit?
Sure. So transgender people face disproportionately high rates of discrimination when applying and trying to keep a job. One in four transgender people have been fired from a job they already have simply because they're transgender. And so these ordinances, these non-discrimination protections, try to prevent that from happening. They try to prevent transgender people from being thrown out of restaurants or movie theaters or grocery stores. And unfortunately, the vast majority of places in this country still lack protections in those areas. But the amazing thing, the really startling thing that makes this bill in North Carolina so much more aggressive and extreme than some of the other bills we've seen is not only the consolidation of all of these anti-LGBT measures into one bill, but as you alluded to earlier, this bill also rolls back 50 years of civil rights progress within the state. People of color, religious minorities, women used to have a remedy for discrimination at the local level that they no longer have now because the state came in and said cities can no longer pass non-discrimination ordinances. This must be and has to be an issue of statewide concern. And for a party that espouses local control, for a party that says the best decisions are made closest to the people, this is government overreach at its worst.
And so what are some of the things that are happening now on the ground. This happened very quickly. Like you said, this was introduced and passed and signed, you know, all within a day on Wednesday of this week. How are various advocates, I should say, regrouping to address what's going on to ensure that rights can be restored?
Well, I think we have an uphill battle in North Carolina. I think one of the things that people have to look at is the next election. We need people to show up and make sure that they are inserting LGBT equality into the electoral conversation. This is a result of an incredibly extreme legislature and governor that were elected 4 years ago. And moving forward, I think we also have to make it clear that this is bad for North Carolina's economy. Businesses are overwhelmingly opposed to this type of discriminatory legislation and overwhelmingly in favor of the non-discrimination protections that were passed in the city of Charlotte. And so for North Carolina or any state to continue to rebound from the recession, for North Carolina or any state to expand economic opportunities for their people by not just making sure you can't be discriminated against, but by attracting new businesses, they have to make clear that they have LGBT inclusive policies and laws. So we need the business community to step up and stand out against this law. It's not too late, even though it's been signed into law. In Indiana, we had the legislature and the governor rescind their overly broad RFRA after the fact. But I also think that the impact of this legislation underscores the need for the progressive community to come together and stand against this type of legislation. Because just as we saw in North Carolina and as we're going to see in other states, it's not just LGBT people that are impacted by these anti-LGBT bills. People of color lost protections, women lost protections, religious minorities lost protections, and then people living at the intersections of those identities are facing double, triple discrimination from their own state government.
And while this was, I think, some of the worst news of the week when it comes to LGBT rights, there were some positive developments in the country when it comes to advancing the cause of LGBT rights. In your own home state of Delaware, we saw some developments. Can you explain what happened? And actually, I just want to give a shout out to Sal McBride, who was on the radio this week, Sarah's wonderful mother, who's a increasingly great advocate on these issues. But can you tell us what's going on in your home state?
Sure. So 3 years ago, Delaware became one of the 18 states that now has protections based on gender identity in various areas of life. In Delaware, that includes insurance. One of the most common forms of anti-LGBT discrimination that still exists nationwide is discrimination in insurance against transgender consumers, particularly exclusions that say that we will not cover any medically necessary transition-related care. The Delaware Insurance Commissioner just came out and said that that can no longer happen in Delaware, that's a violation of the state and frankly, federal law, and that transgender people now have equal access to medically necessary care that these insurance providers are covering in other instances, but are uniquely rejecting in the instance of transgender people. That type of action, though, I think having an elected official standing up for instance, in this time, transgender people, having elected officials stand up for us is a reminder that for those of us who are privileged to live in these more progressive states, we can't let our guard down. We can't forget the people who are living in North Carolina, the people living in Indiana, the people living in Kansas, who not only, again, have elected officials who are standing up for them, passing bulletins that forbid insurance discrimination or passing non-discrimination laws, that they not only don't have those folks, but they have people who are spending time and valuable money trying to legislate discrimination into their state law.
And this is serious. As you know, we were talking off the air that trans youth, trans men and women have higher rates of suicide. This is something that's medically necessary, and it's something that is crucial to the lives of trans men and women in this country. And you know, this is an issue that we care a lot about on Talk Poverty because of the rates of trans homelessness is huge. So I think that this is an issue that, you know, people like to talk about the trans tipping point or this broader recognition of the severity of our laws as it comes to treating trans men and women as equal citizens and full participants in society. This is something that is crucial just to lives. I want to underscore how important these laws are.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point. We know that roughly 41% of transgender people attempt suicide at some point in their lives. And that's not because transgender people themselves have anything in them that would necessarily make them more likely to have or try to commit suicide. It's because society so often puts up barriers, so often exposes them to violence and discrimination that leads people to think that the only choice they have is to end their lives. And we have a study that just came out in the Journal of Homosexuality the other week that demonstrated that when transgender people do not have access to shared facilities, sex-segregated facilities in accordance with their gender identity, that has a real and tangible impact on suicide rates. It's not just a theoretical point. We have data to back up that when this discrimination occurs, when what North Carolina just did happens, lives are lost. And I think it just underscores the fact that in this fight, every day matters. We need our allies. We need the progressive community to stand up, to embrace transgender people, to fight for trans rights, to keep trans people from being thrown out of their homes, to keep trans people off the streets, employ transgender people, and vote for and support candidates who embrace and support inclusive laws.
We've spoken about efforts that your team are backing at the federal level before on this program, but you know, for folks just tuning in for the first time joining us, can you tell us about the bill that you all have been working on?
Absolutely. The fact is that most Americans don't realize that nationally, LGBT people still lack explicit protections from discrimination in areas like employment, housing, public accommodations, education. And so this past July, just a month after the Supreme Court's ruling on marriage equality, LGBT advocates, along with over 150 senators and representatives, joined together to introduce the Equality Act, which is a comprehensive LGBT non-discrimination bill that adds sexual orientation and gender identity to our nation's existing non-discrimination laws in employment, housing, public accommodations, federal funding. Why that is so important is not just to provide LGBT people with the same federal rights, but also to provide them with a recourse for when their state does things like the North Carolina legislature just did. If we had that bill, there would be an opportunity not just for LGBT people to be protected in individual instances, but for the state government to face ramifications for their action. We have a couple avenues for that right now within education based on existing sex protections. North Carolina may lose $4.5 billion in federal funding for passing this bill. But we need explicit laws to make sure that regardless of who's president, regardless of the interpretation of judges, that this type of action by the North Carolina legislature is clearly and permanently illegal.
Sarah McBride, Campaigns and Communications Manager for the Center for American Progress's LGBT team. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And we're joined in the studio with Alan Pike from Think Progress for another installment of The Weekly Worst.
Good to see you again.
It's been long enough that you're giving us sort of passive-aggressive looks of like, did I do something? Why haven't you invited me back? Am I reading that right?
I think I just have resting resentment face. don't take it personal.
It's kind of like resting bitch face, but it's different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's also a glint of suffering in your eyes because we know you went out to a concert last night, but I'll leave it at that.
You're gonna help him on radio.
I didn't say anything about
it. I'm not doing anything wrong. A man can go see Pusha T one night and come and, you know, fight the good fight at work. We're modern people here.
All right. So
are you guys ready?
I think we're ready. What's the first story?
Okay, first up, Congressman Dennis Ross, a Republican from Florida, used a hearing last week with Consumer Financial Protection Bureau head Richard Cordray to basically flagrantly lie about payday lending regulations. He tried to get Cordray to agree that Florida's law is a gold standard and should be seen as a gold standard form of regulating payday lending nationwide. That's simply not true, and we wrote a story pointing out that there's one chart that puts Florida's outcomes from its regulations side by side with Colorado's. You can see that on average, a payday loan is about twice as expensive in Florida as in Colorado. The average borrower is paying APR of 304%. It's a 300% interest rate in Florida versus about 121% in Colorado. Because again, the point here is to get a moderate regulation in that will, these things will still be very, very expensive, but not wildly abusive as they are in Florida. So Dennis Ross pretending that a law that is quite demonstrably terrible is actually great and should be used as the gold standard.
And trying to use the hearing as cover for for the horrible laws they have there.
Well, in his defense, I mean, maybe he just didn't understand what gold standard meant. Maybe he thought that it was, you know, all I have in my head right now actually is that instead of gold, that like the symbol that represents Florida's payday law should be like the poop emoji, like the one, the one with like the face on it.
Yeah, it's a Mr. Like, Hanky's.
Like it's not that. Or it's not gold. It's that.
The gold standard could also be some of the Trump logos from his property.
And those are gold.
Kind of different, yeah,
they're
different
kind of gold.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it sort of is a gold-plated thing.
Like, yeah.
Like, it looks very shiny on the inside. And inside, it's, you know, nickel and copper. And
it's a poop emoji with a veneer of gold.
It's a gold, a gold-plated poop emoji. We found it.
This was our most, like, serious analysis of an important issue. Yeah, but I think it just goes to the fact that we've covered this issue a lot. This is just ridiculous. It was outright lies. So I don't know what else we could say about
I'm feeling
it.
Good about our analysis there. I don't know about you.
All right, what's the next story?
Next up is local to DC, actually. So Mayor Muriel Bowser here in Washington, DC, is trying to replace the central homeless shelter in DC, which is called DC General, with a network of sort of much smaller distributed shelter spaces and permanent supportive housing spaces, with I think like one in each of the 8 wards of the city. Which is a really great idea and a really important thing to be doing, given that DC General is in decrepit shape and is really unsafe and is deserves to be a national scandal in a lot of ways. Unfortunately, that plan hit a sort of unforced error of a roadblock last week, because it turns out that several of the sites that the city wants to lease for these new shelters around town are owned currently by people who've given significant amounts of money to Muriel Bowser's.
Happening with the relationship between developers and mayoral candidates or sitting mayors is just, it's frightening.
Yeah.
And we
yeah.
wonder why trust in government is at like bin Laden levels.
Right.
It's really infuriating. And part of what's so infuriating about it is that the plan as it stands is pretty clearly a good plan.
Right.
It has really broad support, both like among the community and on the council, I think. I made some calls to do some reporting about this, and the mayor's office was pretty upfront about they're adamant that there was no actual intent or even ability to intentionally direct some of this money toward people who've given to her campaign, because the people who picked the sites, the committee in charge of going through their options and deciding where to site these things, had no information in its files about the ownership of the site. So they made these choices blind of that information, according to the mayor's office. But you know, pretty obviously doesn't matter if there actually was something corrupt that happened or not. If it looks that way,
right.
That gives ammunition to the people who, many of them are like me, young white professionals who haven't lived in the city all that long, who like to raise sort of bogus, not in my backyard kind of gripes about the idea of a shelter space or a permanent supportive housing unit.
Something to be clear that you don't do, just people who look like you.
Yes, no, I don't participate in local government at all.
Because we were about to have an issue. Right, yeah.
No, but my colleague Alex Zielinski went to a couple of the community meetings that were had in D.C. a couple weeks or a month ago now. And you can get a flavor of how some people respond to this idea.
Yeah, I was going to say there are a couple things at play where it is this. It looks like there's foul play, so people are going to be dismissive of the whole project. Or there's the other thing that you're alluding to is that I think a lot of young progressive people like the idea of mixed income communities, but once they're coming face to face with the shelter being built in their neighborhood, they start to have false assumptions that it will be related upticks in crime and these sorts of things. So the fact that this appears to be something that is not on the up and up. It's something I hope that the mayor's office addresses swiftly and has as much transparency as possible.
Was part of the mayor's office's answer to you that she just happens to be really good friends with everyone in D.C.? They couldn't find anyone that didn't love her and who wasn't her really good friend.
Nobody made that argument, although that's good comms work.
I mean,
you should put something in the suggestions box.
I'm not just a co-host of a radio show. Remember, I'm also a non-practicing lawyer.
I think
plenty more where that came from.
I think we're sort of we're circling around the central idea here, though, which I think Tracy mentioned a moment ago, which is, yeah, like, everybody's so dialed into the developers, or the developers are so connected to everything in D.C., and the real estate market here is nuts. I wasn't able to confirm this anywhere, but one of the things that the mayor's spokesman mentioned to me was that at one point during one of these meetings about a site, when they were still picking sites, they were in the process of talking about, like, they were sort of going through their agenda and they were in the process of talking about this one site that they might be able to get. And while they were talking about it, somebody got a text and said, "Oh, actually, that parcel just got bought."
Jeez,
by like, it's just it's
not
a crazy,
surprising.
It's a crazy set of constraints they're operating under, and it also speaks to some real serious
right.
failures over a long period of time that precedes Mayor Bowser.
Right.
We should probably do a whole segment on this.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we have to go to the third story.
Number three is to check back in on what's been going on in Flint.
Which is still our reigning weekly worst
worst. Perennial weekly worst. So as folks probably know, Governor Rick Snyder has gone to great lengths to try to shrug off responsibility for what happened in a variety of ways. And the strategy, the communication strategy from Snyder's office has sort of shifted repeatedly. They've been moving the goalposts around to try to keep culpability off of him.
I feel like shrug is a generous and diplomatic word. I think we need a stronger verb there, like throw with the weight of a million barbells. But please continue.
It's like they're like cat burglars, sort of like doing like elaborate backflips around, you know, the alarm system, laser beams.
All right, what you got, Alan?
Now I'm picturing cats doing backflips. I know you said cat burglars. Sorry.
So an investigation, a formal investigation into whose fault this all is, was published earlier this week, and it lays the blame squarely at Snyder's feet, Snyder's office. The state is fundamentally accountable for what happened in Flint. The Flint water crisis is a story of government failure, intransigence, unpreparedness, delay, inaction, and environmental injustice. So it's going to get a lot harder than it already was for Rick Snyder to keep trying to put this off onto somebody else.
Absolutely. I think the report also outlines that, yes, there were things that EPA officials could do, local leaders could do. So I think it outlines how government can be better in general in these sorts of situations. But at the end of the day, it places blame squarely on the state, and which makes it so much more worse of how they were just dancing around this issue and really trying to pass the buck rather than just saying, we made a failure and this is how we're going to address it.
And it's not just placing the blame at the feet of the state, right? It's also, we can't lose sight as we have a conversation about this, no matter how many episodes we devote to it, that it was Governor Snyder appointing an emergency manager who then made these kinds of decisions, and that local officials were, you know, responding to and having to adhere to and to move forward with. But you know, to quote Kurt Guyette, whom we had on the show a couple of months back, the investigative reporter who broke the story, the emergency manager was really carrying out austerity-fueled autocracy. Right,
absolutely.
Taking away power from folks who had actually been put into office through through votes that were cast by the people who live there.
So, in our 30 seconds left to vote on this issue, I'll kick things off. And just as always, Flint's going to be my vote. I wrote a piece, I think last week, about trust in government, and I think that now that this is exposed, it's really just underscoring how hard it is to it's going to be for leaders to restore trust in Flint. And I actually think that underscores the need for a federal role. But every part of the story is always the weekly worst for me.
I have to agree. I almost never agree with you on Weekly Worst just because it's less fun that way and because, you know, we all like to hear ourselves talk about various things. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a radio show. I have to agree with you. And also, I just want to put in a plug for the piece you just mentioned because it's not just about trust in government. The column that you wrote, it's about specifically trust in government among communities of color. And Flint's water crisis is exhibit A of why communities of color are really justified in a lot of ways in having low trust in government. But your piece also kind of makes the case for how government can do better and why it needs to be given a chance to
right.
do better.
Thank you for explaining my own piece better than me. Alan, your vote.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
I normally do the protest vote thing here, but I'm with you guys. It's Flint. And specifically this, I mean, every story about this has been so terrible, as we've said. But this one in particular bothers me because I'm old enough to remember when political leaders used to come out and say, the buck stops with me, and not have to have somebody spend a bunch more time and money going through the records of what you did to tell you, right, by the way, this is your fault. You should right. stop pretending this
right.
wasn't your fault.
Well, we have a unanimous vote. Flint is
hasn't happened in a long time.
Always the Weekly Worst.
But thanks to Rick Snyder for helping us come together.
The
unity candidate, right? Maybe yeah. that's what we'll be hearing about next in the Republican primary.
Exactly. All right. Thanks as always, Alan.
Good to be here.
See you soon. And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.